Well, a very good evening to you all, and welcome to Christchurch Banstead, to the first evening event in our Real Life Open Week 2019. It's really great to be able to welcome you. My name's Andrew McKenna. I'm one of the ministers of the church here. I'll be your host for this evening, so you can generally blame me if anything goes wrong. Shortly, we're going to meet our special guest and hear some of his life story. Before that, let me just take a few minutes to explain how the evening will work, to let you know some things you might like to know. Hopefully, you managed to get a drink as you came in. In terms of practicalities, there are some men's and ladies' toilets just in the foyer through the direction you came in that you're welcome to use. At the close of the evening, there'll be some more toilets available through the door to the side of the stage. If you've got one of these weapons of mass distraction, then please pop it at least on silent and out the way. I'm going to shove mine over there. Now, the format of this evening is fairly simple. We'll have an extended interview with our guest, Tim Cross. After that, I'm going to give a short talk from the Bible to close. We should be done about 9:30 or just after. You're very welcome to hang around for as long as you like. Now, Real Life this week we're putting on is a week of events exploring the heart of the Christian message. That's what we want to do this evening. And here at Christchurch, we believe that you haven't really explored the heart of Christianity unless you've taken a good close look at Jesus Christ, who our church is named after. We're going to hear from our guest about his own encounter with Jesus, and we're going to read about another encounter that another soldier had with Jesus 2,000 years ago. It's from the Gospel of Luke in the Bibles. Luke got together some eyewitnesses who saw what happened in the life of Jesus, and he wrote it all up for us. The reading's going to be on our screen tonight. If you want to check it out later, just go to the bookstall or ask one of the stewards for a Bible, and you'll be able to investigate it yourself. I'm going to read this account to kick us off and to frame this evening. Jesus had just finished a very long teaching session, and we read this in Luke chapter 7, verse 1. When Jesus had finished saying all this to the people who were listening, he entered Capernaum. There a centurion's servant, whom his master valued highly, was ill and about to die. The centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal his servant. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him. This man deserves to have you do this, because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue. So Jesus went with them. He was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to him, saying, Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I did not deserve to have you come under my roof. That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him, and turning to the crowd following him, he said, I tell you, I have not found such great faith, even in Israel. Then the men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well. We're going to return to that account later on, but let me introduce you to another soldier, our special guest for tonight. Now retired, Tim, come and join me. I was going to give you the big build-up. I still might do that. This is Major General Tim Cross, CBE, commissioned into the British Army in 1971. Have I got that right? He commanded at every level, leading a small bomb disposal team in Northern Ireland, right the way through to commanding a division of 30,000 people towards the end of his career. Now, it's easier to name the sort of theatres of conflict that Tim wasn't involved in over his 40-year career in the armed services. Everything from Northern Ireland, the Cold War, Cyprus with the UN, the First Gulf War, the Balkans, planning military operations in Iraq. Following his retirement, he was the Army advisor to the UK House of Commons Defence Committee for 7 years. Tim is now also a lay minister in the Church of England, chairman of the board of the Christian think tank Theos, an honorary professor at 3 universities, president of the Institute of Civil Protection and Emergency Management. This is some retirement, Tim. I could go on, but let's hear from the man himself. Please, let's welcome Tim Cross. I think I need to sit down after all that big list. There's a big picture of you looming over us there. Where was that
photoshopped?
Photoshopped.
It's about 10 years old, that picture, I'm afraid.
It's sort of hanging over us, like certain things do, like public inquiries and other things. Now, you gave evidence at the Iraq inquiry a few years ago, didn't you? The Chilcot inquiry.
Chilcot inquiry, yeah.
Well, we'll come back to that a bit later on, get the lowdown on Mr. Blair, Mr. Rumsfeld, and the rest of them. But before the days of inquiries and post-war planning, even before you first put on an army uniform, take us back to your early childhood. Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in London, but I didn't stay there long. I was adopted by my father. My mother married my father. I think she was the sort of housekeeper because he had two children. His wife had died. She'd been killed. And my mother worked for him. And then he worked for Shell, and he was posted to Australia. So to be honest, I think it was a marriage of convenience. I think he just said to my mother, you know, I need you to help look after children. Why don't you come with me? And he then adopted me. So I lived in Australia till 1956. Came back through the Suez... Well, we couldn't come back through the Suez Canal, actually, because the Suez crisis was on in 1956. And then we lived in various places around the UK. And then Dad retired to Somerset in 1960, 61, 62. So I went to school in Somerset, and then I joined the army as a... well, I joined as a cadet, actually, in 1964. Mm. So that was sort of barely 20 years after D-Day. And... Went to an army sixth form college and then Sandhurst and then was commissioned in 71.
Did you always want to be a soldier growing up?
Yeah, I did actually. And I often say to people, how many people here have any affiliation with the military at all? Yeah, it's not unusual to have one or two hands go up. I mean, in 1964, everybody knew the military. Everybody understood the military. They'd had brothers, uncles, fathers. Everybody had been involved in World War II. Many of them had been involved in World War I. So, you know, the military was well known. Everybody understood the rank structure. Everybody understood how it operated and so on. Mm. So it wasn't unusual for, you know, for a young lad to want to join the military. I was not a particularly, has to be said, a hard worker at school. I wasn't interested in education, really. I played a lot of sport, joined the Cubs, joined the Scouts, joined the Cadets. It's really all I wanted to be was in the military. Mm. And so I tried to join up the regular army when I was about 15. I wanted to join the Somerset and Cornwall Light Infantry, and I was too young. But the guy I went to see was very helpful, and he subsequently got me in when I was 16 to an army college.
Great.
So it's all I ever wanted to do.
So you go through Sandhurst, you're commissioned 1971, and you end up in the mid-70s in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
What was that like back then at the height of the Troubles?
Yeah, Northern Ireland was called the Troubles. We weren't at war, in theory, for all sorts of political reasons, it has to be said, more than anything else, which is interesting in the context of all the inquiries and the fact that we're talking about taking soldiers to court, you know, after Bloody Sunday inquiry and so on. The Troubles started in around 68, 69, 70 when I was at Sandhurst and Army College. They were, of course, not new. There'd been trouble in Northern Ireland or in Ireland as a whole for, you know, quite a long time before that. But the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland and the Troubles, as we understand them, started about then. In the early 70s, we were losing about 300 members of the security forces a year killed in Northern Ireland. And, you know, we as a society have forgotten that, really. Mm. We lost about 170 soldiers in Iraq over a number of years. Mm. We were losing 300, not just soldiers, the Ulster Defence Regiment, the police, the Greenfinches, various other organisations dealing with security in Northern Ireland. So it was a pretty rough place.
Mm. And you were on the front line bomb disposal?
Yeah, we had at one stage we had 26,000 British soldiers in Northern Ireland trying to keep the peace. And amongst that was the terrorist problem of bombs and improvised explosive devices and so on. So I ran a small team. I was part of a big organization, but I ran a small team dealing with ammunition issues in the round, including dealing with IEDs and so on. And it was an interesting time.
Mm. Tell us about Felix. Who was Felix?
Felix, all the military have code words. So over the radio, the IRA would often kidnap people and then take cars and things, put bombs in cars and drop them all over the place. In Northern Ireland on a Friday, for example, around Belfast, they would often hijack about 10 cars, drop them around Belfast, put a bomb in one, and then just pass a code word to say we've left a bomb, you know, on the road. Mm-hmm. And it would then take us hours to clear all these things and so forth. But the police would then, the call sign was Felix, was Fetch Felix. Felix, of course, well, I say of course, is a cat. Cat has nine lives, so the ATOs were known as Felix because we needed a few of those nine lives.
And did you have a 100% success rate? Did it ever go wrong? What was that like?
It didn't go wrong for me. An awful lot of these call-outs were false alarms, were people pretending to put bombs down and so forth. Mm. I mean, there were lots of interesting stories, but often, too, you're investigating what happened afterwards.
Yeah.
So the first job I went to on Northern Ireland was at a restaurant called the Le Mans restaurant. So a bombing. The IRA, if you imagine, this is the restaurant. The IRA had put a plastic explosives, a litre can of petrol, and a box of soap flakes on the wall, which was then detonated, and that created a napalm effect that swept through the restaurant, killing and maiming an awful lot of people. And so we were called out after that had happened and had to find out, try and discover what had happened and how it had worked and all that sort of stuff. Mm. So it was pretty gruesome business, but it was part of the deal, really.
Yeah. I'm sure there's many of us would love to quiz you more about that era. Such an interesting time, often for tragic reasons in military history. But we must fast forward into the decade of the 80s, decade of my birth. Would you believe it? And where were you posted in the 1980s then? So you didn't stay in Northern Ireland. Where did you get to on your travels and your various roles?
Yeah, essentially I served over 4 decades. So the 70s and the 80s were Cold War. So the old days, of those of you looking around the room, there are certainly some of you who are around then. A Cold War, Russia-led Warsaw Pact versus NATO, America-led NATO. Divided Germany, for the youngsters amongst you, Germany was divided between East and West Germany. Berlin was divided into 4 zones, Russian, British, American, and French zones. And we had, the British had a corps of about 60,000 soldiers deployed in North Germany alongside Americans, Dutch, Belgian, and German military. We had about 30,000 main battle tanks and about 5,000 combat aircraft permanently deployed in Germany. Mm. And if you traveled around northern Germany, just about every major town and city had British garrison, British troops. Mm. So I served 4 tours in Germany as a young second lieutenant and then as a captain, as an adjutant of a battalion, a company commander of the battalion, and then I commanded the battalion over the period of the 80s, late 70s and the 80s. And then in the midst of that, I did a tour in France, which was rather nice, doing a guided weapons program, living near Paris, near Versailles, and then did a couple of other tours in the UK along the way. So Warsaw Pact, Cold War dominated, really. Mm. And, of course, it all came to end in 1989. And I can remember, I was back at the British Army Staff College as an instructor at the time, and as the Cold War came to an end, we all sort of almost literally looked at each other and said, what are we going to do now? There's nothing to do. Well, we soon found out.
Yes, not long after 1989, we arrive in the 1990s, and there's a war that kicks off in the Gulf.
Yeah.
I remember, not that it's my life story, but being a little boy, posting a package to my uncle, who was serving with REMI at the time, electrical mechanical engineers, and hoping this parcel got to him and where he was in the Gulf. Were you there at the time, 1991?
Yes, part of the British pushed 1st Armoured Division to join the Iraq. Iraq invaded Kuwait as the Cold War came to an end, basically. We took a huge peace dividend. I mean, the government took a lot of money out of defence. Nobody thought there was going to be another problem, and almost literally overnight, the Iraqi army invaded Kuwait. So the Americans sent a very strong force out initially. We put a brigade with them under what was called Desert Shield to defend Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And to stop the Iraqis taking over the northern oil fields in Saudi Arabia. And we then reinforced that with another brigade and then a third brigade and the whole of the 1st Armoured Division. And I was part of 1st Armoured Division with a guy called Rupert Smith, who was the GOC, the guy who commanded it. Mm. So we went over in 1990, and then the war was over pretty quickly, actually. It was a very... Mm. Good. It was a very good campaign. From an international law point of view, it was very clear. Iraq had invaded a sovereign country. The UN passed a resolution very quickly. The international community came together very quickly. We deployed the force. We started the campaign. And in all honesty, we just thrashed the Iraqis, really. It was all over relatively quickly. Kuwait was liberated. We came home. This was not to be repeated in 2003, which we'll come on to in a moment.
Yeah.
But it was a very clear-cut, very clean campaign.
So Gulf War One, what was your role then and rank, and give us an idea of how you were doing things at
that time? I was a lieutenant colonel working in the divisional headquarters, running essentially the logistics of the campaign. So in the Cold War years, we had planned to fight what we thought the Warsaw Pact, the Russians would cross the inner German border, and we would fight a defensive campaign in Western Europe with good communications, good connections, good lots of stuff, ability, fuel, and so forth would be readily available, and we would fight a defensive campaign, which we hoped would stop the Warsaw Pact. If that hadn't happened, then we would have, to use the phrase, gone nuclear, tactical and strategic nuclear weapons, culminating in what was called MAD, mutually assured destruction. MAD by name, some may think MAD by nature, but it worked. In the end, deterrence worked. This time, of course, we were several thousand miles away, fighting offensive operations in the desert, and it was a completely different logistic situation, difficult. But nonetheless, the campaign was successful, as I say.
Yes, that's right. Now, I suppose the rest of the 1990s, in terms of conflict and your involvement, centred around the Balkans. Would that be correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I should have said in the 1980s, I also served in Cyprus with the United Nations.
Yes, thank you.
And served there for a year, and it was whilst I was there that I became a Christian. We went to Jerusalem, and we may come back to that. Yeah. So I'd become a Christian in the 1980s, which had a major impact on my life. And the Balkans really began to develop in... Tito had died, Yugoslavia began to break apart. The UN put a peacekeeping operation into the Balkans initially, but there was no peace to keep. And eventually there was an agreement at a place called Dayton, and NATO put in quite a strong force. And I subsequently did three tours in the Balkans in 95, 96, 7, and then 99 in Kosovo. And that was a period, that decade was a really interesting period for all sorts of reasons. If you imagine on a spectrum on the floor here, and over this end is complete peace, and over there is high-intensity war fighting, which is what the Warsaw Pact and NATO would have got into if they had come across the inner German border. This end is complete peace. Out of interest, in recorded history, there have only been about 300 years of global peace where there's not been a war going on somewhere. So it's very rare to be down that end of the spectrum. But then high-intensity war fighting, limited war fighting, and then in the middle here you've got peacekeeping, peace support, peace enforcement operations, and then humanitarian operations down here, a whole spectrum of stuff. And Cyprus was peacekeeping, and the Balkans, and what happened there, and indeed in Rwanda, we began to see the emergence of ethnic cleansing and terrible events going on. Rwanda, 800,000 people massacred, not using modern weapons, machetes basically, killed 800,000 people. And then these early years in the Balkans, ethnic cleansing from the Krajina in places like Croatia and Bosnia, and indeed, there was no goodies and baddies in all of this. Everybody was having a crack at each other, really. But it had a huge impact on people like Kofi Annan, who became the UN peacekeeping boss, United Nations Department of Peacekeeping, and indeed people like Tony Blair. It framed their view that as we'd watched these terrible things happening, that the world could not stand by and watch whilst people were massacred in these huge numbers in places like Srebrenica and so on.
Yes.
And Tony Blair was the initiator, really, to give him credit, for the Kosovo operation.
Yeah.
I deployed in Kosovo as a brigade commander. I was then a brigadier.
Uh-huh.
And Tony Blair convinced the Americans to get involved. Kosovo was a very successful operation again. We can come back to it in a second if you'd like to. But
but
it framed Tony Blair's view of the world. And in academic terms, a lot of people began to talk about something called conditional sovereignty. Sovereignty is, as I'm sure most of you will know, is the fact that each independent state looks after itself and nobody will interfere with your business. So, for example, World War I didn't start because we didn't like the Germans or they didn't like us. It started because they invaded Belgium. They crossed into somebody else's sovereign territory. And in 1939, World War II started because Germany invaded Poland. So, the idea of sovereign states, we will keep out of your state if you keep out of ours, that was the way it ran. And that came out of, in some respects, the Treaty of Westphalia, the European wars and so forth back in the 1700s and 1600s. Conditional sovereignty meant you can have your sovereignty, If you imagine each of these tables as a different country, you can have your sovereignty, but if you start slaughtering the people inside your own country, we, the world, will not stand by and watch it happen. Mm. With modern communications, with the ability to know what's going on, we have a moral duty to do something. And that was, you know, Tony Blair gave a famous speech in Chicago, which essentially talked about the responsibility to protect, that we, the West, we, the world, would come and do something if you started slaughtering your people. And that, and Kosovo was really the first time that that was implemented, and it was a success. Yeah. It led Tony Blair and others to think about Iraq later on in that same context, and in my view, they got that wrong. But the principle is not a bad principle.
Yeah. So you on the ground there in the Balkans, I would imagine in your position commanding many people, you have some very weighty decisions to make, often with very short notice.
Yeah.
Take us to that a field on the Macedonian border, and your phone rings.
Yeah.
Who's on the other end?
Yeah. Yeah, the Kosovo is an interesting context in all sorts of ways, an interesting crisis in all sorts of ways. But essentially, the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, deployed two British brigades to Kosovo, or intending to go into Kosovo. He deployed them through Greece into Macedonia, thinking there would be some sort of peace agreement at a conference that was going on in France at the time at a place called Rambouillet. And the Dayton Agreement that had come up with the agreement to deploy NATO forces back in 1995, people saw Rambouillet as being the equivalent of a Dayton. So they expected some sort of solution to emerge. Milosevic refused to go along with it, and therefore Rambouillet fell apart, by which time we had two brigades inside Macedonia, my own brigade and four armoured brigade. NATO started bombing Serbia. Some of you will remember this. Started bombing Serbia in all sorts of ways. And there was a massive crisis of the movement of people inside Kosovo. Mm. When people move as a result of these crises, but often they'll initially move within the country. So, and they're called IDPs, internally displaced people. When they cross an international border, they become refugees. And a lot of people, tens of thousands were IDPs. That was building. When we started bombing Serbia, that number increased dramatically. Mm. The Serbs literally knocked on people's doors in places like Pristina, the capital, and said, if you've not gone by breakfast time tomorrow morning, we are going to come in and kill you and all your family. And so people, not surprisingly, got up and left. And they left by train, they left on the roads, walking, everybody, families, old, young, and so on. The men tended to disappear into the hills to join the Kosovo Liberation Army, who were, to be honest, not a bunch of nice, particularly nice blokes. They were pretty brutal and ruthless. But this mass of IDPs and then refugees, and a lot of them went into Albania, and then there was a big build-up on the border with Macedonia. And my brigade and four armored brigade were training, and at that stage preparing to fight our way into Kosovo. So we had deployed to this deployment thinking we were going to be involved in somewhere around here on this spectrum of operations, some sort of peace support operation. We were now bombing Serbia and preparing to fight our way into Kosovo, so we now had to move up the spectrum into higher intensity operations. And we were preparing to do that. I then met a guy called Joe Hegenar, who worked for the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. Joe led a small team, maybe a couple of dozen people, who'd been inside Kosovo and were trying to work out through some of this business of the UNHCR. And it was all out of control. There were thousands of people on the border, tens of thousands of people, out in the open, no shelter, no food, and people were beginning to die. And the weather, actually surprisingly at the time, was pretty awful. So Joe said to me, can you help? It's a longer story than this, but essentially Joe said that. Same time, this is over the Easter weekend of 1999, same time the phone rings and the Macedonian foreign minister, who subsequently became the president and actually was subsequently killed in a helicopter crash, rang me and said, if I let these people in to Macedonia, can you guarantee that you look after them and will not allow them to enter Skopje, the capital, or go anywhere else inside Macedonia? And I'd chatted to Joe sort of 2 or 3 days before this. But when this guy rang me, I hadn't anticipated that we were going to be, in the middle of all of this. Mm. But he obviously needed an answer. And to be fair, it sounds a bit harsh put that way. But to be fair to him and Macedonia, they had watched all the other Balkan states go through civil war in the previous 10 years. He did not want a civil war inside Macedonia. And he was genuinely worried that if he allowed these tens of thousands of refugees in, that that would create real tension. And they had had a lot of other people come into Macedonia over the previous 2 or 3 years. Anyway, the bottom line is he needed an answer. And I just said, yes, it'll be fine. I hadn't got a clue how we were going to deal with this. I hadn't got a clue how we could possibly deal with the problem. But he needed an answer. He needed reassurance. And I made that decision for a couple of reasons, one of which was from my Christianity, if you like, the humanitarian piece, but also from a military point of view, an operational point of view, there was a real danger that we were going to be locked in the middle of the civil war. So bottom line is we built and ran refugee camps. So we were running humanitarian operations over here for about 2.5 months in Macedonia and then in Albania and then subsequently in Kosovo. So the brigade was moving up and down this spectrum almost literally overnight. And from a command point of view and the soldiers' point of view, getting your mind around what we were doing, how we were setting about it and so forth, you know, was not easy. But it worked out. It worked out well in the end. Milosevic did give in, and the refugee camps that we'd built, which had 70,000 plus people in them, all the people there were able to go home pretty quickly. And as I said earlier, Kosovo was, you know, was a successful campaign.
Yes. Now you hinted earlier about some of the more recent troubles in the Gulf, and we're in the 2000s decade now. Perhaps the fourth decade of your service.
Yeah.
That decade kicks off with the Twin Towers in New York City coming down with the planes crashing in. I'm sure we can all remember, if we were alive then, where we were when that happened. Where were you, by the way?
I was in the UK. I was serving as a general. By now I'd been promoted to Major General, serving in the UK. And I was in London at the time. Like an awful lot of you, got on a train. And everybody was looking at things and talking to each other. I hadn't got a clue what had happened at that stage. And it's only when I got home that evening that I realized, you know, what had happened on September the 11th.
So one thing leads to another globally, and you find yourself involved in the upcoming invasion of Iraq. What was your initial role going to be in all that?
Yeah, the decision that we make, well, not the decision, the assessment that we might well be involved in military operations in Iraq led the government to form and appoint a series of headquarters to do things. When we deploy on a military operation with the British Armed Forces, we appoint a joint force commander, a 3-star general level. In this particular case, it was a guy called Brian Burridge, who was an Air Force officer, fast jet pilot. And Brian was the joint force commander, and you then have 5 what we call component commanders, a maritime component commander, as in the Royal Navy, an air component commander, as in the Air Force, a land component commander, which was a good friend of mine who looked after the armored division, a logistic component commander, which was me, and a special forces component commander, again, a good friend of mine. So we had 5 component commanders and a joint force commander. And we, in the sort of late 2002, September the 11th, of course, is 2001. So by the summer of 2002, the Americans have decided that they're going to do something, which we can come back to. We then set this lot up, and along with my fellow component commanders, we spent quite a lot of time in the U.S. Central Command in Florida, preparing and helping to prepare the military campaign plan for what we would do in order to secure Iraq. And there were various things around. I won't bore you with them all. But at the time, initially, the Brits were going to go in through the north. We were going to use Cyprus as a forward mounting base, go in across the eastern Mediterranean through Turkey, about 200 kilometers down into Turkey to a place where we would set up a big forward base. And then we would go into Iraq from the north as part of an operation to secure the northern oil fields. Around Christmas time, the government, British government, decided that the Turkish government were never going to allow this to happen. And they made the decision that we would not do that. The Americans always felt they could convince the Turks to allow them in. They never did. And 4 Infantry Division, the American division, was left floating around on the Mediterranean Sea doing nothing for several months, which was not a very good place to be. So we shifted our point of entry to the south through Kuwait. where we had been
previously.
So the logistic piece was a lot easier than it would otherwise have been. It would have been a nightmare going through the north, I can tell you, for all sorts of reasons. So I handed over the logistic component command to one of my brigade commanders, and the then chief of the general staff, a chap called Mike Jackson, who some of you may have heard of, rang me and said, I want you to go to America, to go to Washington, and join a team of Americans who are planning post-war Iraq, called the Office of Post-War Planning, run by a guy called Jay Garner. So I went over to the States in January 2003 with my military assistant, who was a naval submariner, a guy called Louis Notley. And Louis and I ended up by working in the Pentagon alongside Jay and his team planning post-war Iraq.
So you're having lunch in the Pentagon one day with Donald Rumsfeld.
Yeah.
And he asks you, what do you think? What do you think of this military plan we've got? What do you say?
Yeah. Yeah, it's the military planning was good, and the military campaign went very well. And it was pretty obvious that we were going to win a military campaign. The issue was what was going to happen afterwards. Yeah. Unlike the first Gulf War, unlike Kosovo, we were going to end up by owning Iraq. That was pretty obvious. Within the Pentagon, Rumsfeld, who is not an idiot, I mean, rather like Tony Blair.
So he
Blair,
was U.S. Secretary of State
U.S.
at the time.
Secretary of State for Defense, yeah. And I know Tony Blair is a pretty toxic brand for most people, and Rumsfeld is a pretty toxic brand for many people. But these are not idiots. They're very capable people with very genuinely held views in many cases, and leadership is not easy at that level. But Rumsfeld's plan was for post-war Iraq, and I do not exaggerate when I say this because I presented it to the Chilcot Inquiry, we do not need a plan. Once we have got rid of Saddam Hussein, once we have destroyed the Iraqi military, the Iraqi people will rise up as one, give us a thunderous round of applause, and want to convert themselves into Democrats and all that sort of stuff. Which was, wishful thinking in my view, but you could say was plan A. But there was no plan B or plan C. So Rumsfeld, who I'd met a few times, we had this lunch that Andrew refers to, with about eight or nine U.S. military commanders talking about what the situation was. And he said to me, he asked me, I wasn't the first person he asked clearly, but he asked me at one point, what do you think? And I said, Mr. Secretary, I think the military campaign plan is fine. I think we'll win. I don't know whether we'll win in 2 months or 6 months, but we will win. What I'm worried about is post-war Iraq. Having been involved in Northern Ireland, where, as I said earlier, we had 26,000 British soldiers in a very small province. Kosovo, there were 60,000 KFOR troops. We're going to own the whole of Iraq, and we're going in with only around 180,000, mostly American, but about 40,000 Brits. And the plan was within 6 months we were going to reduce that to 50,000 Americans and about 20,000 Brits. So I said to him, I just don't think the force ratios work. I don't think we're going to be able to maintain the place. Secondly, we have got to work with the international community. And thirdly, we've got to work with the United Nations. He did not want any of those things to happen. And to be honest, I was just cut out of the conversation. These were not things he wanted to hear. And speaking into the paradigm, and many of you will have experienced this in places at work and so forth, speaking into senior leadership who've got a view of the world, breaking into the paradigm is not easy. And people did. An American four-star general got himself sacked for challenging Rumsfeld, particularly on the force ratios, saying that they would need 350,000 and Rumsfeld didn't want to hear it. So it was, an interesting experience. It was an interesting experience dealing with people like him. Jack Straw was our foreign secretary. I spent a lot of time with him. Tony Blair, I briefed in Downing Street. A number of others.
So you're briefing Blair, saying these kind of things to him.
Yeah, and saying that I don't think we were ready for post-war Iraq. Now, I don't rush to Tony Blair's defence because I think, to be honest, we got this wrong. And for the first time in my life, I was involved in failure. The reality of failure is that we all are involved in failure in some respects, but this was not a pleasant experience. But you're dealing with hubris, you're dealing with difficult leadership situations. Leaders have to make these difficult calls. But trying to speak, to use that rather corny expression, speak truth into power.
Yeah.
But people like Tony Blair have got lots of people giving them advice.
Yeah.
Lots of advisors, lots of people giving their view. And as Margaret Thatcher famously declared, advisors advise, deciders decide. And he had to make some decisions.
Yeah. So you're not sort of washing your hands of all that and just blaming the politicians. You would hold your hands up and say, look, maybe even examining myself here, we got something wrong. Now, what is it inside you, Tim Cross, that makes you respond in that way and not just pass the buck and blame the Blairs and the Rumsfelds?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're faced with failure, you do have a few decisions to make. And one of them, you know, there's lots of reactions to it. We can blame other people. We can hide away from it. We can say it's got nothing to do with us. And I don't take the blame for what happened post-war Iraq, but I was a part of it. And I had to honestly ask myself, what else could I have done? Could I have briefed this differently? Could I have approached it differently? And part of that was a recognition at that stage. I'd been a Christian I became a Christian in 1981, so we're talking about the best part of 20-odd years later. Part of it was a recognition that, you know, I needed to face up to the reality of that I was part of it. The British Army, as I often say to people, is a deeply flawed organization because it's made up of people like me. That's the reality of it. So having to face up to that and then be prepared to acknowledge the reality of it and then accept that those scars are part of who I am today. Those of you who've been through failure, that's a part of who you are. And, you know, you carry the scars, but we can still walk. We may walk with a bit of a limp, but we can still walk. Scar tissue, interestingly, is often stronger than the original tissue when you first cut yourself. So, you know, we can walk, we can come out of these things in a better place, really. But it is important to face up to the reality of it.
We can tell, as you've been hinting already, that a relationship with Jesus as a Christian is making a difference to your life in these kind of areas. Take us back to 1981, you're 30 years old, you get a quick weekend away from Cyprus. Where do you end up and what do you see?
Yeah, it's in those days, looking around the room, many of you remember back in the 1970s and 80s, there were quite a few UN peacekeeping forces in the Middle East, in the Golan Heights, in the Egyptian Sinai Desert and various other places. So there was a plane, lots of UN planes would go around visiting all these UN different peacekeeping forces and so on. And I managed to get two places on an aeroplane for my wife Christine and myself just to get away. Easter weekend, 1981, we got these seats on a plane to Jerusalem. Let's go and have a wander around Jerusalem. We had been married in church. Our children had been baptized in church. We were classic, you know, middle-class British Christians. All very nice, but let's not take this stuff too seriously because we don't want to be embarrassed about it all. But, you know, church was not unimportant to me. I'd been confirmed at Sandhurst, actually, interestingly. Anyway, we went to Jerusalem. We visited Bethlehem. We became tourists. And on Easter Sunday, we went to the Anglican Church in Jerusalem and attended the Easter Sunday service, which was actually a very nice service. I remember it quite well. But over a cup of coffee after the service, we were asked, have we been to the Garden Tomb? Anybody heard of the Garden Tomb? Yeah, quite a few people. Great. Well, for those who haven't, the Garden Tomb is a site outside the old city wall where there is a first century tomb, first century wine press. It's a garden. There's a rock formation nearby that looks like a skull and a couple of other things. General Gordon, who'd died at Khartoum, for those of you who are into military history, had been part of excavating this site as a possible site location for where Christ had been crucified, buried in a tomb. So this was, it is literally a garden. So we hadn't been. We asked where it was. We went round. And in the way that the good Lord does these things, the guide that day in the Garden Tomb was a retired British Army colonel. I was a captain at the time. And forgive me, ladies, but I think men in particular need blokes to look them in the eye, kick them up the backside and say, come on, listen in, let's make a few decisions here. And he, being a good British Army colonel, gave me both barrels, really.
Do you remember what he said? What was the kind of thing?
Well,
I
mean, we went through the Gospels. All the Gospels talk about this, obviously. I mean, the culmination of the Gospels is the crucifixion and, of course, the resurrection. So he talked us all through that. And then he said, and he said it to me, I have to say, more than Christian, because this was very vivid to me. He said, look, this may or may not be the place where Christ was crucified and buried. But if you go and look in the tomb, he said, pointing to this first century tomb, the tomb is empty. And I have to say, feeling a bit of a, excuse my French, bit of a prat, I got up and walked over to this tomb. I don't know to this day what I expected to find, whether I expected to find some body in this tomb or something. But I got up to this tomb, leant on the door entrance, and I just found myself thinking, this is probably the most important question that I could face. If Christ did not rise from the dead, then for the last 2,000 years, millions of people, including every Christian in this room, have been wasting their time, and it is all a load of rubbish. And as Paul says in one of his letters to the churches, we amongst all people are to be pitied. It's a pretty strong expression, actually. But if Christ did rise from the dead, then that is extraordinary, and it is transformation. And I, you know, leaning there, sitting there thinking this, it wasn't a Damascus Road experience for me, for those of you who know the story of Paul. It wasn't a blinding revelation, but it had a huge impact. And I went back to Cyprus, and over a couple of months, talking with friends, a couple of good Christian friend men, and reading the scriptures, I got to a point where I just found myself saying to myself, I just need to make a decision. Mm. You know, either I go along with this or I don't. I was saying earlier on this afternoon, using this analogy that I think is quite helpful. I think it's quite helpful. A very good friend of mine, a guy called General Ian Dury, who was a gunner, Royal Artillery, commanded the artillery in the Gulf War. And we're great family friends. Ian said to me on a number of occasions, and said to a lot of his soldiers on a number of occasions, people become Christians by either traveling up the M1 or the M2. The M1 is the Damascus Road, 1M in Damascus, and is a heart, spiritual, striking experience that suddenly strikes somebody and, you know, gets them to acknowledge and accept Christ. The M2 is the Emmaus Road, two M's in Emmaus. And the Emmaus Road is a story in the Gospels about two of Jesus' disciples who, after the crucifixion, are walking back to Emmaus, disillusioned, fed up, scared, not understanding what's going on. And the story is that Jesus comes alongside them, asks them why they're looking so despondent, and then opens up the scriptures to explain to them why what has happened was going to happen. So the M1 is a Damascus Road, heart-driven experience in many ways. The Emmaus Road is a intellectual opening up the scriptures experience. And as somebody once said, minds are like parachutes. They need to be open to work. So I needed to open my mind. And I am an M2 man more than an M1 man. I needed to clear my mind on this intellectually. But I also then realized that actually at the time, and this may apply to some people here this evening, I was an M25 man. I was going round and round the M25, going nowhere spiritually, and just continuing on an endless journey. And I needed to break away from it. I needed to get up and make a decision. And my challenge to men in particular is, you have to decide. Either you're for Christ and you're on the side of justice and righteousness and so on, or you're not. And for me, that meant I had to decide. And I just decided. I didn't understand it all. It wasn't all that clear to me. There were lots of things I didn't understand, lots of things I still don't understand. But I knew that I wanted to be on the side of justice. You know, I've watched the mass graves being dug up in places. Words like sin and evil are not interesting theological words for me. Mm. They're a reality of a brutal world. Some of the things that, you know, I've seen over the years. And I don't want to be part of that. I want to stand for justice and righteousness. I want to stand for Christ. Mm. So I made a decision to become a disciple. Mm. To use a rather corny expression that's often, jokingly referred to, I was born again, spiritually as opposed to physically. Mm. And it changed my view, and it led to decisions like that decision in Kosovo where, I genuinely believe, as a brigade commander, the good Lord had put me there. There were many people in the military who thought I'd made the wrong decision for all sorts of reasons that I won't bore you with. But, to be in those positions, to enable to make that decision, was a consequence of having become a Christian. Hmm. And I think, as a result of having made that decision, I was a better leader, better commander, and was able to make decisions that otherwise I think I might have struggled with or made different decisions.
Yeah. Lots of us, when we introduce ourselves to one another, we say, hi, my name's such and such. And the next thing we come out is normally, and this is what I do, this is my job. And I was joking earlier, just reading down your CV, all that you could define yourselves as in terms of your career, your achievements, your rank, your status? Where is your real identity now? Where what's it centered upon, Tim?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think it's a good thing to get into. I mentioned earlier on that I was adopted. I wouldn't have said that a few years ago, but I meet now so many people who are struggling with who am I, identity, what is my identity, and what is my purpose? Why am I here? Why are we here? Why are we, collectively on this earth? And I was very struck when I read the Gospels and look at Christ. A, I'm very struck by his bravery, his courage, his physical courage, as well as his moral courage. In the Garden of Gethsemane at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, his mates are asleep. He knows he's going to be arrested. He knows he's going to be beaten up. He knows he's going to be put on a cross, crucified. He could easily have said, actually, I can do without this. I'm off. And nobody would have stopped him. But he doesn't. He stays. And he acknowledges his purpose. And he's able to acknowledge his purpose as the cross, as the culmination of that, because he's absolutely clear and confident of his identity. Mm. He knows who he is. At his baptism, he hears a voice saying, this is my son whom I love. And halfway through Mark's gospel, he asks the disciples, who do men say that I am?
Yeah.
And there's an interesting conversation that goes on, but he then says, who do you say that I am? And I call this the killer question. Who do we say? Who do you say Christ is? And Peter, who's a really interesting character for all sorts of reasons, but Peter says, you are the Christ. You are the Messiah. So Jesus establishes identity and then establishes his purpose. Mm. And, as an adopted child, and I've met many people who've been adopted and many others who struggle with their identity. But I can honestly tell you that my identity is in Christ. I have no desire to know, who my natural father was. I've not searched for anything to do with that. I don't need that. My identity is firmly in Christ. And my purpose is to live for Christ. In the context of, evenings like this, but also in business. I work a lot in business. I work in, Westminster. I'm in Parliament quite a lot. I work with the media. My sort of strap line, if you like, is morally courageous leadership. We need morally courageous leaders in politics, in economics, in the media, and so forth. And that morality and that courage needs to be rooted in something. And for me, it has to be rooted in Christ. That's where I get my identity. That's where I get my purpose. And that's, I think for all of us, knowing who we are and having a sense of purpose in our lives is a pretty fundamental place to be. And it's a great place to be.
Yeah.
I loved every day, it sounds a bit pathetic really, but I loved every day of being a soldier. 43 years, man and boy, I loved every day. I loved the blokes, I loved the environment, and all of that. But I am not defined by the fact that I'm a Major General retired. That's not what I'm defined by. I'm defined by the fact that I'm a disciple of Christ. And that's, when I kneel before the throne of grace, that's going to be the only thing that matters really.
Tim, we've so much enjoyed, appreciated all that you've had to share with us. We're very grateful for you coming up and sharing with New Horizons, our seniors group, this afternoon. You're off to Switzerland tomorrow. Yeah. We appreciate you making time to come and spend with us. If you'd like to read more of Tim's story, you can find it as one of the chapters in this book called City Lives. We've got it on our bookstall. We're going to have a bit more time thinking about Jesus now and that soldier that he met from our reading earlier at the start of the evening. But let's show our thanks to Tim Cross. Wasn't that great? I don't feel like I have to add much. But I prepared to talk to you about this other soldier that we read about earlier. He was a very good man, and sometimes we wonder, why do bad things happen to good people? Consider those in the Grenfell Tower who rescued others and got them to safety, but were killed themselves by the fire, the smoke. Good people. Those ordinary folk we heard about in Kosovo earlier from Tim, quietly going about their lives, yet caught up in a devastating war, ethnic cleansing. Ordinary, good people. And is this man in Jesus' day a soldier? with a servant who he loves, a member of his household. He values him highly, but he was about to die. He was about to lose him. This centurion was a good man. As we observe scenarios like this in other people's lives, maybe in our own life as well, when pain and suffering strikes us, I think it's very easy to write off the existence of a God who made the world and loves the people that he's made, the God the Bible talks about. Well, Christians like Tim and me and others here, we're not immune from that pain. We wrestle with these things too. We don't pretend there are easy answers to these questions, nor do we just shrug our shoulders and just sort of say, it's all right, you've just got to trust God, as if our faith is blind and removed from the pain of real life. But what we do say as Christians is that what we do claim is that in Jesus, that Tim was talking about, we found the ultimate answer to these struggles. In Jesus, we find ultimate hope and meaning and identity. We found someone who makes sense of this broken world because he's come to do something about the brokenness in this world and in us as well. Consider with me this centurion in our reading. He had heard of Jesus. And at his moment of desperate need with his servant dying, he knows he needs Jesus. The question is, does he deserve Jesus? How would you answer that? Does this man, this centurion, deserve Jesus' help and healing? Let's have a reminder of his own CV, what this man had done. Well, his CV was quite impressive for his day, so much that he'd even won over the local Jewish leaders, even though he was a Roman. And so the elders of the Jews even send like a diplomatic delegation to Jesus on the soldiers' behalf to try and lobby for him so that Jesus will come and heal his servant. They say to Jesus, pleading earnestly in the little verse 4 on the screen, "This man deserves to have you do this." They list their reasons why. He loves our nation. He's built our synagogue. This soldier is obviously very noble, respectable. Today, we'd probably win a peacekeeping award for uniting the community. Well, what about you? When suffering and pain strikes you, do you ever get that sense and feeling, and do you say within yourself, God, I deserve better than this? Do you find yourself thinking that? I'm a good person. I've never hurt anybody too badly. So why is this happening to me? Why this sorrow and pain? Why do my loved ones get sick and die? Why is this relationship broken down? If you, like this man, ever had access to Jesus and his power to heal, do you think you would say to him, "Yes, Jesus, I deserve this. I'm a good person. Please, please heal my friend who's dying." It's interesting, isn't it, that the soldier in this reading, he doesn't think that. Jesus was on his way to the house, but then the soldier sends out some friends who pass on this message. They've been saying, "He deserves it." He says, "Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof." See what's going on here. In his need, in his pain, in his struggle, this soldier doesn't rage against God and say, "Why are you doing this?" But he simply realizes he needs God in his life. He's heard of Jesus. By this point, Jesus has been teaching with authority. He'd been performing great miracles. Jesus, if anybody knew anything about the Bible, was obviously God come down to earth. He appears to have all the power of God, yet he is also fully human. And word spreads quickly about him. And so rather than respond in rage, this soldier realizes that he needs this Jesus. But then there's this kind of awkward backwards and forwards in the account. He wants Jesus, but he knows that he's not worthy of Jesus. He doesn't deserve him. He doesn't deserve to have Jesus come to him. And as much as he needs Jesus' healing power, he just has this sense that I'm not even worthy to come out and see Jesus. What's going on here in this story? Well, I think this soldier is realizing something that many, many thousands of people, like Tim was saying, the Christians that have believed this stuff for years and years and years, that many people have realized since. And it's this, that we all think we deserve God's help. We all think God is going to reward us for being good until we look at Jesus, until we see who Jesus really is. See, one look at Jesus and we realize we've been working with the wrong categories. It's very easy to look around rooms and our lives and compare ourselves to one another. And we say, okay, I know I'm not perfect, but I'm better than him and her over there. I'm pretty good. I think on the whole, God would probably accept me and gladly have me in his kingdom. But measured against Jesus and his perfect life, his perfect humanity, his perfect obedience of God, then we realize how far short we truly are, how far we've fallen, how little we deserve God's love and his power. And this predicament that we're in, it can't just be solved by merely rounding up all the really bad characters in the world that have been responsible for all these horrible things and locking them up and doing away with them so that us nice ordinary folk can be free to just sort the world out a bit and make it a better place. Does that sound like a good plan to you? Well, that wasn't the plan that God came up with to remake this broken world. Because, you know, if that was his plan, then when measured against Jesus' standard of goodness, we would all be in that other camp. We would all deserve to be rounded up and punished. Here's a man who experienced suffering firsthand at the hands of communist Russia, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He was exiled from Russia in 1974. He's a Nobel Prize-winning author. He wrote trying to expose the horrors of the Soviet Gulag prison system. Eventually, they sent him to the Gulag for his anti-Soviet propaganda. And one of the things he observed while he was there was something very strange, but so very human at the same time. He watched the prison guards. These guards were by day so brutal, so horrible to the prisoners in the Gulag. But yet they each went home at night and had dinner with their families, did the washing up, and were kind to their children. And so he wrote, having observed this, about this idea, this theory that we could just sort the world out if we just locked up all the bad guys, the evil people. So he writes in his book, The Gulag Archipelago, if only it were so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? The prison guards, the evil dictators, the warlords, the Milosevic's, the Saddam Hussein's, they are all accountable to God. Nothing will escape his searching judgment and perfect justice. But that goes for each one of us as well. We are all accountable to him. And which of us could claim that we have loved God in an undivided way, without that mix of good and evil inside each of us? Loved him with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, which is what God requires of us. And because we have not done that, by not doing that, this is what the Bible describes as sin. Like Tim was talking about, not just bad things we do, but our whole personal rejection of God as our maker. As we turn away from him and we turn in on ourselves. That's been the feature, the posture of humanity ever since the Garden of Eden, ever since Adam first sinned against God and plunged all of humanity into darkness and this world into brokenness. Just like this soldier that sent for Jesus realized, sin means we can no longer approach God. We are not worthy to come to him. God is holy. He is pure. He is light. In him is no darkness at all. And the Bible is clear throughout that this is humanity's greatest problem, that we have rebelled against God our Maker and we deserve his just judgment of our sin. Our greatest need is to have this sin forgiven and this broken world somehow restored. So what's the plan? What's God's plan? We heard earlier about those in authority, perhaps, well, not perhaps, we're being kind, not having a completely thought through plan about post-war Iraq. But God's plan to rescue this broken world has been perfectly formed since this world's foundation. His plan centers on his son, Jesus Christ. Jesus is the one who makes forgiveness possible and who remakes this broken world. If you've ever read or heard about Jesus doing miracles like this one, healing this person or calming the storm or turning water into wine, have you ever thought to yourself, why did Jesus do those things? Was he just sort of showing off or doing them for effect to wow people? As we read our Bibles, we realize the miracles were there for a couple of reasons, really. One, they're showing us who Jesus is. They're showing us that Jesus is God. Only God could do those things. Jesus must be God. He's operating with his power and authority. But also, secondly, these miracles, these healings, like this one of the servant, they show us, they give us a sneak preview of what life will be like in the end when God does bring about the culmination of his plan, the renewal of all things through Jesus, when God remakes and fixes this broken world. So that's the remaking bit. But what about the forgiveness bit? How does Jesus make that possible? Well, he does that by living that perfect life that none of us did in undivided devotion to God. As Tim was saying, knowing who he was and his purpose, he lived that perfectly. He lived the life we should have lived, and he died the death that we should have died, bearing the judgment we deserve. The Bible says Jesus Christ suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. 3 days later, he rose from the dead, defeating death itself, blazing this trail to his new creation. And his resurrection guarantees, as Tim was talking about, that this must be true. And that if our faith is in him, if our trust is in Jesus, then we too will rise and be with him in this new world that he promises. It was 11 days ago. I was wandering up the high street and I popped into Waitrose. And I was struck by the front page of this newspaper. Here's the front cover of the Daily Mail from the 6th of June, which of course was the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And this headline very much sums up the gratitude of all of us, I suppose, as we reflect on the sacrifice made on our behalf by those soldiers to maintain our freedom. A debt we can never repay. But that headline is also true of our spiritual state before God. Our sin is a debt we could never repay. But God does not expect us to repay it. That's the good news. He has made a way, he's made provision for our sin to be paid for in the way that Jesus willingly gave up his life to death on the cross and died in our place. And so, like the centurion, like the soldier, all we have to do to receive God's forgiveness is to admit that we are not worthy, we don't deserve Jesus. And to put our trust in him, knowing that he has all power and authority, that he is God, and that to submit our lives before him will actually mean we truly know real life, eternal life, for the first time. Jesus is a great leveler. His cross, his death is a great leveler. Forgiveness, new life, God's power and love, they're not just available to people who have great CVs or CBEs. This offer is open to all, to everyone who believes. At the end of our lives, when we give an account to God, at that point, the only thing will matter is not that we can point to enough good things in our life to show why God should accept us, but that you've recognized the power and authority of his son Jesus, and that you've put your trust in him and believe that his death was for your sin. That's what Jesus takes delight in and commands in this episode, the centurion's faith. He'd not found this faith in Israel, but he'd found this kind of faith, this kind of belief and trust and laying himself before Jesus. He'd found it in this man. We don't always know why bad things happen to any of us. But when we do experience pain, it's an opportunity, as this centurion proved, not to rage against God and turn in on ourselves and just store up more of this judgment that we deserve for our sin. It's an opportunity to realize our need of God's forgiveness. This realization led this soldier to believe in Jesus' power and to submit to his authority. And for all who do that, for all who put their trust in Jesus, the Bible says we become united to Jesus, connected to him, and we are made new creatures in him. That starts on the inside, in our inner being, but one day it will be fully complete on the outside, in our physical bodies as well, in his new creation. The Bible says if anybody is in Christ, if their faith is in him and they belong to him, they are new creatures. The old has gone, the new has come. And yes, we're not naive as Christians. We do realize we continue to live in this broken world with all its pain and struggles and suffering. And in fact, if you become a Christian, you will experience a whole new angle of pain and struggle and suffering just by being a Christian and the rejection and struggle that comes with that. But you know, it's worth it for where we're heading. Jesus is remaking this broken world, and there will be a new creation where nothing evil will be ever present. Tim and colleagues will be very much out of a job, where pain will be a distant memory. That's what we believe as Christians. Do you want to join us? How do you do that? Well, you admit that you don't deserve Jesus like that centurion did. Admit that you are not worthy of him and bow to his authority. Trust in his death on the cross for you. Turn from your old life of selfishness and sin and rejection of God to put your faith in this Jesus. Because only in Jesus can you be made new and have your sin forgiven. How will you respond?